This next topic is one that is particularly near and dear to my heart. It is Collision Course, our Second Amendment, and the International Gun Control Agenda. In my bio, a couple of years ago, it said, and the author of the soon forthcoming book, Collision Course. Well, that would have been really great if things had stopped at the United Nations, but they didn't. But I promise you, it will be done in November. My last 8 years at the United Nations and other events internationally have been eye-opening. I have had the privilege to work with Alan Youngman and with Mark Westrom, who have done more for us as gun owners than we can possibly be aware of. Mark is particularly conversant with ISACs, which is just something you guys have probably never heard of. I know you've all heard of the ATT, but you should be very worried about ISACs. You should be more worried about ISACs. And Alan is one of the most diplomatic people and universally liked at the United Nations, and he's been extraordinarily helpful. And as for in my case, the education that I've received has been amazing. But one of the things that I would like to say is we stand up here, as the gentleman said, and I stand here. This is representative of our side, as I would say, at the United Nations. It's me and the boys. And we are all over a certain age, and it is not a diverse group that you see here. The people on the other side are generally young enough to be our children easily. And they're from all over. They are very, very well financed. Some notes here. Okay. They are extraordinarily well financed. They're extraordinarily well organized. The money they get out of governments and they get out of the EU, and it's mind-boggling. They actually have more money, I think, than they know what to do with. I'm hoping some of the power that has gone to their head will come back a little bit and make their lives a little more difficult. That's something that Alan will speak to in a moment. But right now we're dealing with the ATT, the POA, the COP, ISACs, the BMS, the OEWG. That's just some of them. We also have a distinct issue that is coming more and more to the forefront, and in terms of the international thing, is what we believe in the United States, and the things that are important to us in the United States are things that have very little to no interest to people in Europe. Self-defense is something they don't get. They simply don't get. They simply cannot understand why you would want to defend yourself. It's just an anathema to them. While our lead concerns here have to do with the environment, their lead concerns, and this is a very big deal, have to do with the amount of lead that is in the game meat that is sold in their supermarkets. So it's very hard to bring all this stuff together. I would like Mark and Alan to take and explain some of this to you, explain some of the history, explain some of the from the munition side, which is very important, and from the military side, and then Mark to explain that growing beast that is ISACs. Thank you.
Well, good morning. I'm Alan Youngman. I'm the Executive Director of the Defense Small Arms Advisory Council, and Mark Westrom, who will follow me, is the President of the organization. We are the only non-governmental organization accredited to speak before the United Nations, representing only the defense small arms industry. We're comprised of most of the most of the U.S.-based. I did something wrong, right? Okay. Ignore you?
Ignore
you. Right.
Just ignore me.
All right. And so we provide a fairly unique perspective when we speak before the United Nations, because every nation on earth asserts its right to defend itself, which means necessarily they need something to do that with. And so we got in the door that way about 8 years ago and been working the issues ever since. And of course, the big issue has been over the last 10 years, the arms trade treaty, which was culminated last year after lengthy negotiations. It was not intended to be at least labeled as a small arms treaty. It was supposed to deal with attack submarines, combat aircraft, and things like that. But very quickly you find out that 99% of the energy, the money, the rhetoric, and everything else has to do with small arms. Last year, about this time, Secretary of State John Kerry signed the treaty on behalf of the United States. The President of the United States was urged by some of the people on the other side to sign it. He delegated that to Kerry. It would have been an opportunity for the President, if he had signed it, to explain at the time he did so through a signing statement that we view in the United States this treaty as limited to exports and imports. It has nothing to do with domestic possession, transfers, sales, use of firearms. He declined to do that. And there's certainly a message there that he did not avail himself of that opportunity. The likelihood is that the ATT will not be presented, this is my prediction, to the United States Senate as part of a campaign to have it ratified in the lifetime of anybody in this room. And that was not ever really the goal, I think, behind some of its advocates. I say that because if you look at the CIFTA, the Inter-American Arms Trade Treaty, which is kind of a, you know, small-scale one, President Clinton signed that in 1997, and it still has not been brought on for even a preliminary hearing in the United States Senate, even during times when the Democrats control the Senate. So it's kind of a toxic thing, as we try to explain to some of our friends in the U.N., that no American politician ever got one single vote by saying something nice about the United Nations. I mean, it's just not a priority for most of us. Also, you have to have 67 senators to ratify a treaty. 58 senators have signed letters from both parties, mostly Republicans, but some Democrats, saying dead on arrival. There's no protection for the Second Amendment in the Arms Trade Treaty. Don't bother sending it over. But that could change over time. Several speakers have talked to you about the importance, the critical importance of getting engaged in races in your state, particularly Senate races, because of the makeup of the Supreme Court. Let me give you one more reason. Everybody in this room, every time there's a Senate election in your the rest of your life, you need to find out how both candidates stand on the Arms Trade Treaty. You know, I'd like to see it similar to an anti-tax pledge. A pledge, if I'm elected, I will never, ever vote to ratify the Arms Trade Treaty. And it's important because of the nature of the treaty. Despite what Secretary Kerry said when he signed, he had some throwaway remark about it respects the Second Amendment. Well, no, it doesn't. We all wish it did, but that language just simply cannot be found in the treaty. And I'll say on the other side that there's nothing in the treaty that directly attacks civilian ownership. In fact, there's some throwaway language that says mindful that there is a legitimate trade in lawful ownership of firearms in places where that's permitted by law. Now, that is in the preamble, but you find treaty advocates saying there's language in there that protects your right to keep and bear arms. No, it doesn't. It's in the preamble. First of all, this is not nearly that strong. Secondly, the legal effect, any international lawyers in here? The operative legal effect of something in a preamble is ranked right up there with the language at the bottom that says printed on recycled paper. Okay. Nice to have, not a lot of strength there. And that's the strongest language you can find in the treaty that supports your right to keep and bear arms. The bad stuff that almost made it into the treaty. There was a lot of language circulated out there that would really impose draconian measures. Didn't make it in. And there's two real reasons for that. One of them was the involvement. Every time the subject came up for discussion over the last 8 years. The Second Amendment Foundation, Julianne and Alan were there. National Shooting Sports Foundation, SAMI, our organization, DSAC, of course the NRA. And we were there to backstop the U.S. delegation. So they didn't just hear from the anti-gun crowd. And I'm going to go ahead and embarrass her. One of the most powerful voices at the UN has been Julianne's. What you typically have is a room with 500 people in it, arranged alphabetically from countries around the world. Frequently, the only face of gun owners that they see that is not old, white, and male is Julianne's. And that makes a difference. Now, the rest of us can stand up there and talk about these things, but when she talks about the right of self-defense, and particularly the empowerment of women who can protect themselves, who are not totally dependent upon males who may have more or less an ownership relationship with them in some parts of the world. A lot of these folks from around the world sit there and they get quiet and they listen. Of course, for some of them, the idea of an armed woman who can control her own fate is terrifying. You get to know some of these folks over the years, and they're not all bad people, and some of them are pretty nice folks. And this one fellow from another part of the world came to me after Julianne spoke and said something as, "She's talking about my wives owning guns?" And I says, "Yeah." He says, "Really bad idea." Well, maybe you need to start working on your marriage or marriages. But the other reason that the bad, really bad language did not make it into the final text was the work of a guy named Don Maley. I want to talk about him just for a second. Don was the chief U.S. negotiator. Were you guys in Orlando 2 years ago? Or Houston last year? I'm going to tell the story again. Don was a retired Army colonel who then went to work for the State Department. And became the chief negotiator on the arms trade treaty. As we went into the final round of negotiations in March 2 years ago, Don was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He literally gave the last 2 years of his life to this effort. You need to know about Don. As he would walk across the floor of the UN, the stares and the whispers went, he was reputed to be a member of the NRA. And I mean, people were like, I mean, Don was absolutely brilliant, like a Jesuit scholar, just sharp wit. And Don was a gun owner. Well, in Orlando 2 years ago, our organization, asked Julianne Allen, could we use that occasion to present him with what we thought was a token of, appropriate appreciation for his work. So Colt donated a 1911, which we presented him at the conference. And I thought he'd take it home and just put it on the shelf. Well, the next time I saw him at the UN, I said, "You shoot?" And he said, "I take it to my range there in Fairfax, Virginia, every Saturday morning and shoot." I said, "Well, that's great. Now, how many 1911 fans do we have in here?" I knew it was a good group. I said, "By the way, I got to say this: all those signs you see on the front of stores saying 'no guns' that with a slash through, they're all Berettas." Anybody notice that? Okay, so I'm not sure how I feel about that. But Don said, "Well, I'm shooting it, but I'm having a problem with it." I said, "What are your problems?" He said, "Well, I'm a right-handed shooter, and everything's going low and left. I've got instructors in here. What's that tell you? You know, probably got trigger finger problems." And so I said, "Well, remember during your military career, he used to shoot on the Army pistol team." He said, "I never had that problem." I said, "Well, you're shooting a 1911 A1. The difference between the 11 and the A1 is part of the frame was cut out behind the trigger, so your finger wouldn't come in contact with it." He went, "Oh, yeah." So we were standing there. This is during a break in one of the UN sessions. And I said, you got to make sure you start working that trigger finger from that third knuckle, not the second one. Otherwise, you're going to be putting, pressure on the frame." And so he's doing like this and everything. And we looked up. And there are 500 pairs of eyes looking at us. and I went like this, and Don went, "Screw them." So I just want you to know, Don passed away in March, and we miss. He was a powerful, good friend to all of us who worked there, and to the Second Amendment, and to American gun owners. Talk real quickly about the rest of what's in the Arms Trade Treaty. Is the response? How much time I got? How am I doing? Okay. Jillian's already accused some of us speakers who know the routine of being somehow responsible for the fire at the FAA facility, because it means we get longer to speak. Big part of what is in the treaty is emphasis on the responsibility of states, countries, to effectively regulate firearms in their country and to prevent their diversion to illegal sources. Diversion is the magic word. A lot of what the energy behind the Arms Trade Treaty came from Mexico. They view this whole effort as a direct and deliberate assault on the Second Amendment and had no bones about saying so. They thought that in order to prevent diversion of arms that might end up in Mexico, that the U.S. should disregard the Second Amendment. And they've said so many times. One of their primary objectives was to set the stage for an attack on the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. Remember, that was passed in 2005 to prevent the gun industry from being bankrupted with frivolous lawsuits. And they wanted to define transfer in the treaty as any change of possession that could possibly lead to diversion. This is because this is a common theme throughout the international gun control movement. They view every illegal gun as one that started life legally. And therefore, instead of going after the illegal ones, you go after the legal ones. Constrict their, their production, their ownership, their sale, things like that. They say that'll solve the problem someday. And Mexico is foremost among the adherents to that philosophy. They have hired during the treaty negotiations, they hired a New York law firm for the specific purpose of finding ways to attack the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act should the U.S. sign. And they are now in firm control of the post-treaty implementation process, and that's important. And the U.S. has limited influence because we're not a party of the treaty and likely never will be. We found out that the first conference set the stage for what they're going to do next was last month in Mexico City. They outsourced the decision-making. Now, the Mexican government is obsessed with the idea of sovereignty. But they outsourced decisions about who could attend this conference, even to observe, to Control Arms, one of the anti-gun organizations. Anybody remember Rebecca Peters? Well, she's gone, and their philosophy is no more Mr. Nice Guy.
Oh, no.
Anna McDonald is the new Rebecca Peters, and actually Rebecca was easier to work with. The treaty is going to go into effect probably around the first of the year.
Actually, the 53rd country signed the treaty. It then goes into effect in 90 days. They have pushed this so that everybody knows that it goes into effect on Christmas Day, but they forgot their 31 days in October.
What are you going to do? So what are we going to see? One of the real goals, strategic goals of the other side, is to isolate the United States. Make us look like an outlier because we allow our citizens to own firearms. And that's a recurrent theme. In terms of practical impacts, you're probably not going to see anything immediately. One of the reasons is the U.S. government says we're already in full compliance with everything that's required of the treaty. All we were trying to do is get the other people in the world to comply with the same licensing standards for exports and things like that. The other reason that the administration is saying that is to get around congressional prohibitions on spending money to implement the treaty. They say, well, we're already in compliance, so we don't have to do anything, so we're not spending any money that way. But we could see a few other impacts. For example, there are a lot of those in the European Union who would like to see a regulation there under the treaty that would require an end-user certificate for any firearm exported from Europe. In other words, the name, address, et cetera, of the person who's going to end up with that firearm. Now, if you're a European firearms manufacturer who normally ships firearms to the United States, you ship them to a distributor, right? The distributor then sends them out to retailers. The U.S. government does not issue end-user certificates. So what's going to be the impact if that regulation were to be imposed? I don't know. Maybe a lot of those gun manufacturers will move their factories to the United States. That'd be okay, wouldn't it? But things like that. But down the road, it's hard to tell. What we're seeing is that convergence between the treaty as a major vehicle for some very specific agendas. The Program of Action on Small Arms is one of them. It's kind of a playbook of what countries ought to do. And then Mark's going to talk about Isaacs in a minute, which is the actual recipe, the nuts and bolts of how you impose gun control under the Arms Trade Treaty. I want to close out with one thought. My sense is, the Senate is our last line of defense, and we're in pretty good shape there. The only way that we can lose this fight long term is if we lose credibility with the United States Senate. I mean, they know what's going on. We need to remain engaged with them on this subject, but we need to be careful. We need to stay as well informed as they are. And I'll be real honest, and this is not politically correct. If all they hear from you is cut and paste talking points from a huckster like Dudley Brown about the black helicopters are on the way, I heard them last night, they're coming to get the guns, you can imagine how your United States Senator is going to start characterizing communications from you. We don't need to do that. This thing is serious enough as it is without us blowing our credibility by saying things that simply aren't true and everybody knows aren't true, but may fit into the fundraising plans of some folks out there who are not engaged in this fight, except trying to raise money off of it later. That's just about as straight as I can put it. So anyway, thanks for what you're doing. Stay informed, stay engaged. We're going to win.
Good afternoon. I'm going to be brief, partially because I'm hungry and partially because I don't want the ISIL enforcer here to shorten my speech.
She has backup.
I have spoken a little bit before about ISACs, the International Small Arms Control Standards, and they are significant. We have much more clarity about what the devices are now than we had last time I spoke on the topic. A little background. DSAC is not a civil rights organization. Now, basically all of us in the organization are gun owners and are NRA members and such. But when we go to the UN, we are a technical organization, an industry organization, and that puts us into a kind of a separate category that gives us credibility that a lot of the gun rights organizations don't have. We're lucky that Second Amendment Foundation, NRA, NSSF, SAMI, do have good credibility from the civil rights side. But we stand apart and it limits some of the things we can do. I'll have one example of a nice little victory that came out unexpectedly, kind of on the civil rights side. About the UN. It's an exasperating organization. It's necessary from a world standpoint. It does some good things, but it's a big government organization, and it's heavily influenced by big government, fix the world organizations, and these NGOs that we talk about, those are non-governmental organizations. And unlike lobbyists in the U.S. who cannot walk into the floor of most senates and houses of representatives, the NGO is actually a member of the UN. It's not a member state, it's a member organization. It's the lowest life form in the UN. But you go into that General Assembly hall and you've got a table and you've got a nameplate and you've got a microphone and sometimes you get a chance to speak. So we do have some opportunities. Now, the UN has been interested in disarmament for generations, and they've had some victories, and now they're looking at small arms in much more than they did in the past. No bureaucracy thrives without redundancy, and the UN is a prime example of this. They've got organizations with overlapping interest in regulating small arms for safety, ecological, or women's rights, or whatever reasons. To resolve some of that, they created something called CASA, the Coordinating Action on Small Arms. And it ties together UN organizations. Department of Peacekeeping Operations, World Health Organization, Office on Drugs, Institute for Disarmament Research, Development Fund for Women. All of these organizations have formed CASA, and they have created something called ISECS. Now, when it started, in the latter half of the first decade, ATT was in trouble. There was a lot of resistance from the UN, and it looked like it would not be approved. In fact, I went to Geneva to attend an ATT meeting and was surprised to find that it wasn't an ATT meeting. It was an ISACS meeting. And it appeared to me that ISACS was kind of an end around to a failed ATT, that it was another effort for them to create, kind of a world law. What they did was they created a set of standards. Now, standards are not like treaties. Generally, treaties are enacted and it requires consensus. That means unanimity in UN speak. And with the U.S., for instance, and some other nations opposing, it was very unlikely that it would be be passed. So ISACS was created under the Disarmament Affairs folks to create these standards with, at first, 24 modules. Not all have been created, but enough have been created that we see some of the dangers. We also see some of the benefits because not all of these modules are bad things. When they talk about import, export, transit controls, that's the detailed business type things. That's the world that we live in, and we see that they're taking standard provisions and actually trying to sort of bring the UN into conformance with the highest standard in the world, which is the U.S. standard. Controls over manufacture, that's another one. Design of control programs. Then they got kind of amusing. I suggested that they avoid things because what they call cross-cutting issues can have a tendency to discredit their focus or lose their focus. Children and small arms and light weapons, gender, youth, and some of the definitions of youth extend into the 30s. We're going to protect the youth from small arms. Victim survivor assistance. And so some of these things are getting away from, administration of law and regulation concerning transfers of jets and aircraft and getting a little bit political. I had the audacity to suggest leaving some of that stuff out, and you can imagine how welcomed I was by some of the people on the floor. But in any case, they have ended the initial work on ISACS, and they've got a number of modules going. The one that's kind of up in the air that's most important concerns civilian possession and let's see, where is it? National controls over access of civilians to small arms and light weapons. The fellow that wrote that is a guy named Edward Lawrence. He's a professor of public administration, human security and development at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. And he is a diehard anti-gunner. He has written a draft. It is not adopted yet. And we rather think that that's because it keeps some of the focus off of that module. It's still a work in process. It has provisions that we would be suspicious of. Some of the core elements include that a phrase, where permitted by domestic law, civilians may apply for a license. It requires justification. Limits on what you can buy and how many. Registration may be required. Now, throughout these documents, they use the words may, must, shall, can. So depending on how those words modify a section of the document determines the adversity that we would be subjected to. Secure storage, reporting a loss, revocation. I didn't see anything about there about restoration of civil rights in the document. I did see one thing that I'm very proud of, and it relates to something called the Achaki Principle. At the first session, first meetings on ISACs, the ones that surprised us, they almost danced for us to make a presentation. They call it an intervention. They don't say speech. They wanted an attendance from the industry. You know, at one of those big meetings, there's 300 people in a room, and the guy was proud that even industry was here, and the industry was moi. I was it. But in this first session, there were five presentations. The first session is the most important, and I was asked to speak. More importantly, it was a fellow named Meir Ichaki from the government of Israel, and he made a very important statement. He said that a standard has to bear in mind the differences between nations. In some nations, the citizens have a right to keep and bear arms. And he actually used the words. In other nations, the government has the right and may extend it to citizens. Any standard needs to consider both circumstances. And in Lawrence's document, by God, he's got the Ichaki principle in there. They only heard it a couple of times, you know, since we're not Second Amendment guys, we were able to make little references to it indirectly in documents. And in one case, in one episode only, I can't remember the other side made some statement that left a glaring opening and allowed me to remind everybody of the Ichaki principle and what it meant, and step out of the industry role just a little bit to be inclusive. That's where this came from. Years going to those meetings, and that's the biggest thing that we accomplished under the ISACs. Now, I urge you to go take a look do a search for ISACs or Monterey Institute, and take a look at the ISACs. There's a list of these modules. The ones in bold-faced type are the ones that are completed. The ones that are not in boldface, including women, children, and youth, those are in draft, or maybe they're being ignored. Now, what they're going to do with this, where am I going? What they're going to do with this is define these as the world standard. Now, Sammy walked out of this process because of misuse of the term standard. A standard, according to the ISO, which briefed us in Geneva, a standard requires consensus, unanimity. And these standards do not. They are not using the term standards in the usual sense. So when they come out and say, hey, this is the world standard, this, Mr. Legislator, is what you should be supporting, it's not true. So we have to oppose on that grounds, and we have to know what they're doing, and we have to be prepared to oppose. Last thing I'm going to say, because I want to be able to walk off the stage, is I agree with what Alan said. Both Second Amendment Foundation, when I was heading Armalite, have suffered the indignation of some of the people in our world, in our hobby and such, who are enthusiastic but less than wise. What I would recommend is that all of us maintain some attention on what people are saying and how they're saying it, and urge them to become a little better informed and to write better, perhaps. Illinois State Rifle and Pistol Association reminds people frequently that when they call their legislators to be polite, things like that. And you've seen on the internet the panicky guy that spins up all his buddies and how rumors about the Armed Trade Treaty kept getting worse and worse and worse. That only detracts from our message. So that's one of the things I like to concentrate on now, too. Have I got any time left? Okay. Thank you very much.
One of the things that I would like to say is when you go and you look at ISAX and you go and you look at Ed Lawrence, he's with the Monterey Peace Institute. He's a graduate of West Point. He taught at the Naval College, and those are his credentials to be the guy who's telling us how all the weapons should be handled and what the standards are. He also was one of the founding members of IANSA. So, again, pay attention. In ISACS, we have the ATT, which is obvious, but then the people who are doing the standards, that's not being negotiated. So pay attention, because that's a real stealth move. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would go outside, grab...